Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. It has been a litigious 4th of July week for the state of Florida. It finds itself defending the rules over medical marijuana and is poised to become a defendant over allowing charter schools further access to public tax money. But the state also has a deal now to drop a separate lawsuit filed against it by the Seminole Tribe. That deal could mean millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of gambling revenues coming into the state. Now, Florida is not the only level of government finding itself party to lawsuits this week. Miami-Dade County was sued over allegedly detaining a man at the request of immigration officials. The suit claims the man is a U.S. citizen. So how best to celebrate the week of Independence Day than a week of legal maneuvering in the Sunshine State? That's where we are here on this edition of the Florida Roundup. Should Broward Public Schools take the state to court over charter school funding? Do you support one government body threatening a lawsuit against another? Should your school district also sue? And what about marijuana here in Florida? If you voted for medical marijuana, did you think patients would be able to smoke it? Or is that just too far as the state wrote rules for medical marijuana? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us your thoughts via Twitter, at WLRN is our handle. Let's begin with a reporter for the Associated Press in Tallahassee. Gary Fineout is with us from our sister station, WFSU, in the capital city. Gary, how common is it for the state to face a lawsuit or the threat of a lawsuit over laws that are, in this case, just days old?
Actually, very quite common, especially in the last several years with the administration of Governor Rick Scott and the Republican-controlled Florida legislature. We have had a bevy of lawsuits. I mean, you can go all the way back to Governor Scott's first year in office when they basically increased the retirement contribution for state workers to 3% of their salary. That went all the way up to the state Supreme Court. We've seen multiple lawsuits on things involving vouchers, and there was the lawsuit against the law trying to ban use of state funds on companies tied to Cuba. That was eventually struck down by a court. We had the Docks and Glocks bill that was passed. That was struck down by a federal court. So it is, in fact, fairly common practice that with the Democrats out of power and with the Republicans in complete control, many of the opponents of these policies have turned to the courts.
And with that in mind, is that a particular feature of essentially the one-party rule that we've seen in Tallahassee over the past almost decade now?
Well, we've actually had one-party rule in Tallahassee for close to two decades.
Yeah. The party has just changed, though. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
More recently, Republicans holding power.
Right, but what I would tell you is that the when things were a little bit closer. And there, especially then, we had Governor Crist, who was sort of not always on the same page with the legislature during that period of time. We have definitely in the last 7 years, with the agenda being pushed by Governor Scott, which has a lot of times had buy-in by the legislature. It basically has been that a lot of these things have wound up in the courts as groups like the American Civil Liberties Union. They have sued multiple times on multiple issues.
So the state finds itself in a very familiar position with a new fiscal year and a new set of laws taking effect, and that position is as a defendant. Let's begin with education, this particular lawsuit. It was Wednesday night when the Broward County Public School Board became the first in the state to move toward a legal challenge of that huge education law, 7069. Let's listen.
So I would like you to entertain, for one of you maybe to accept this motion, that the Office of the General Counsel requests that the school board authorize it and the superintendent to retain outside counsel in collaboration with other school districts for the purpose of filing a legal challenge to HB 769 within the scope of the information presented in this agenda item, and the amount of the legal costs and fees will not exceed $25,000 without further school board approval.
All in favor of item one as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you.
All right, a unanimous decision Wednesday night by the Broward County Public School Board to authorize lawsuit against the state over this House Bill 7069, which is a state law now in the state of Florida. Mary Ellen Klass joins us now. She is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for our partner, the Miami Herald. She's with us from our sister station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Mary Ellen, before we talk about the lawsuit itself, remind us what 7069 does. How big of a change is it for education policy?
Well, it does a lot of things. I think the most significant of which is it revises the formula of the in terms of the amount of money going to charter schools that previously had been allowed in state law. Right now, their charter schools are considered public schools, and under the changes that have been made, public schools now don't. Charter schools now get money following the student, so that money that was going from the federal government to the state will now go to the student in the charter schools, and that means there's going to be less money for the public school system. There's also incentives in place here that allow that punish school districts for having a number of for having schools voted as a failing school for 2 years in a row. It opens the door for charter schools from around the country to come in and replace those schools, replace the entire administration, replace the teachers, and it really sets up kind of a new system, something that is untested and uncharted in Florida.
Go ahead, Mary Ellen. Go ahead.
Right. And then there's a lot of other things having to do with teacher bonuses, you know, a long list of other things. But those are sort of the elements, I think, that the Broward system has identified as inequitable.
And the legal counsel in the Broward County school system in a memo described the law as establishing a duplicative, competitive private system for education. Caitlin McClay joins us now. She is the education reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. She joins us from our studios in Doral. Caitlin, why did the school board vote to authorize this legal action? What does it hope to get out of it?
They hope to block the bill from going into effect. They're going to argue that...
I'll let our engineer know I cannot hear Caitlin, so we'll return to her in a moment. Gary, find out how significant is it when this large school district follows through, if it follows through, with an actual lawsuit here? What could it use as leverage, as an authorization for a lawsuit before it actually gets into court?
Well, it's important to understand some constitutional distinctions here that I'm sure I wasn't at the Broward meeting, of course, but I've watched this issue is that school boards have generally argued that the school districts are constitutionally created entities and that they have certain powers that are delegated to them. And in regards to the main part of 7069 that caused a lot of heartburn for them was the basically Tallahassee legislators ordering them to share their local property taxes. And they will go into great detail and say, look, the Constitution makes it clear that only local entities have the power to levy property taxes. The state does not have the power to levy property taxes. So therefore, we have control over how we spend these property taxes. Now, and that said, there are statutory things about how we do taxes and things of that nature. But that's what they're upset about. And then in regards to the duplication issue, if you want to go back in history, the important ruling Bush v. Holmes, which was the lawsuit challenging Governor Bush's voucher program that he first set up in 1999, the final ruling that came out of the Supreme Court hinged on a phrase in the Constitution relative to the paramount duty of the state to have a system of schools. And basically, in the argument that the court used to strike down the program, they said it is illegal in Florida to set up a, quote, parallel system. You can't have one system where public money goes this way for one set of schools, and then there's a separate system of schools over here. And that's essentially what it sounds like the Broward County School Board is going to argue, is that, hey, we've got our public schools. They are supposed to get this money. You cannot force us to send money over to a completely competitive entity that we do not have complete control of. Of course, charter schools do have to have agreements with the local districts, but they are privately run, and often they're run, while they are public schools, they are often run by for-profit companies.
Correct, and have in some cases a different set of labor agreements with teachers and other administrators, but presumably under Florida law there is oversight on the part of the public school board when it comes to the charter schools that are operating. Caitlin McLeod is now with us, the education reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Caitlin, what does the school board of Broward hope to accomplish by this threat of a lawsuit?
They hope to collaborate with several other school districts and move to block the law from taking effect. They're going to argue that it's unconstitutional for many of the reasons that he just addressed. They would have to share property tax with charter schools, which not only will they argue that it's not laid out in law to allow that to happen, but also the ramifications of that could mean that their bond ratings could be downgraded, as pointed out by Moody's Investors Service recently.
What's the timeline for this strategy, though, Caitlin?
They're hoping to file sometime this summer. The other school districts that they're looking to work with are having similar meetings over the next couple of weeks. And right now, Broward is seeking outside legal help to work on the case.
We know that the Miami-Dade County Public School District has a workshop scheduled for July 26th to discuss all the options, including legal action. We also reached out to the Palm Beach County Public School District for a comment. They did not provide us with one. So is Broward prepared, Caitlin, to go it alone if it winds up in that regard?
I'm not sure I can answer that question, but I do know that they are pretty confident that other school districts are going to join them. The legal counsel at Broward had a phone call with 10 other school districts recently that all shared very similar concerns.
And as Mary Ellen pointed out earlier, this law, this 7069 law, does a number of things. I mean, it has the funding mechanism for schools of hope. It has the shared capital ability of charter schools for capital and maintenance dollars, but it also deals with teacher bonuses. It also mandates elementary school recess for public schools. Is the Broward challenge against the entire legislation?
Actually, one of the points of their argument is that the law says that law should only address one subject, and they're arguing that because it addresses 69 different statutes, it kind of violates that. As with regards to whether that kind of an argument would work, the likely outcome, Broward said, is that a special section could just be had to divide up the bill into numerous smaller bills if they were to go after that argument.
Caitlin McLeod is an education reporter at the Sun Sentinel. She is along with us here on the Florida Roundup, as is Gary Fineout with the Associated Press, Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald. Let's go to your phone calls, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We will start on line 3 in Hollywood. Linda, welcome to the Florida Roundup. You are on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'd just like to express my admiration for the Broward School Board against the House Bill 7069. As a private citizen, I have always thought that the public school system was very essential to our democracy, and I do not approve of my tax dollars going for profit-making or even non-profit charter schools. We've had a great deal of problems over the several last years with schools being in business for as little as 3 weeks to 3 months and then going broke and owing the county a lot of money. I just do not approve of taxpayer money going to charter schools.
Linda, we appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for listening and for joining us here on the Roundup. Let's go to line 2 in Pompano Beach. Mark is on the line joining us on the Roundup. Mark, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Exactly how much money are you talking about leaving the public school system, going into these charter schools? I mean, it just seems like every year the state of Florida is taking more money from the hardworking citizens of the state to provide education for those who can afford education at private schools, the upper class.
What's at stake here, Caitlin?
The Broward school system is looking at losing about $100 million over the next 5 years. I think Palm Beach County is looking at a similar amount. In addition to that, staff at the Broward County School Board meeting the other day mentioned that they could seek to lose a lot more in having to pay off debt service if their bond ratings get downgraded as a result of the bill.
So Broward says $100 million at stake over the next 5 years. Palm Beach County, its number was $230 million over the next decade. Miami-Dade has said $250 million at stake over the next 10 years. Mary Ellen, how do these school districts lose the money under 7069 if it stands as state law?
I'm really glad you focused on that because they're not losing the money. This is all taxpayer money, and it's all going to public taxpayer, what the legislature has deemed as money that goes to the public. Charter schools also serve the public. They are just not under the control of the school boards as precisely as the traditional public schools. So the notion that they'd lose money is sort of in the eye of the beholder. Of course, the proponents of this indicate that it's money that is going to be more efficiently spent and directed in a way with more flexibility and without the restraints and impositions of unions and things like that. So it really is a perception question, I think.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, please do, Gary Fineout. Yeah.
And I wanted to add a little bit of context. We were talking about the districts, obviously, in South Florida. An analysis shows that in the first year alone, it would basically shift $96 million statewide from public school districts to the charter schools. I think the important thing to remember here is that the Associated Press, we did a project just about a year and a half ago that showed over a period of time that approximately $70 million had gone to charter schools through state appropriations to schools that later closed. And that's one of the parts of the issue here is that in general, most school districts, because these are primarily capital dollars. Let's understand what they are. This is not money that you would pay to hire a teacher per se.
Right.
This is money that you would
right.
use to acquire something. And
right.
that the
like
situation
computers
with charter schools
or classroom goods or you know
or
instructional materials or a building, right.
And a lot of charter schools, what they do is they lease their facilities. And so what these capital outlay dollars are usually used for is a lease payment to the other entity that had paid to build the building. The issue here is that if something happens to the school, then there is a question of what the taxpayers could actually recover. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you have if you do the traditional way and you do a brick and mortar school and you build it, and if the school district for whatever reasons decides that they no longer want to use that building, well, they have the option of selling the building. They have the option of selling the real estate. There's that. In this instance, what you're talking about is there's the possibility that what you're going to have the money going to is to a lease payment to a third party and an inability to recover the money possibly. I'm not saying that's universal, but that is just to highlight that you create a lot of issues in terms of how charter schools are managed and how public schools are managed.
And that is not something that they addressed in the legislation as to what – It's not addressed in current law, and it's not addressed in this new law either.
And was that by design, Mary Ellen? Was it acknowledged?
Well,
they
have been
ignored?
Very aware. Obviously, the Associated Press's investigation has been out there. They've been very aware. Legislators have been very aware of this problem of not being able to claw back any money from failed charter schools, and they chose not to remedy that problem. One of the other things about this, the allocation or as Gary called it, I think the shifting of $96 million
mm-hmm.
is
right.
That money is going to districts in a formula that we have not had yet explained. There are some districts that are losing 30% of their capital outlay dollar, while others only lose 2%. And the question is why is there sort of this inequitable shifting of money, and how did they arrive at the formula?
Yeah. Let me bring Caitlin McLeod back in, the education reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Caitlin, what was your sense in the Broward County Public School Board meeting on Wednesday, the appetite by the school board as well as those folks present to really push this potential lawsuit forward? In other words, the board's authorization accounted for $25,000 in legal fees, which may not get too far in this litigious environment that we're in. So how much capital, you know, potentially could they be willing to put forth in this effort?
Well, the board was very adamant that they go forward with this. One of the board members referred to the law as strong arm robbery. Another referred to it as essentially kind of putting the district in a situation where they have to magically pay for things that they're required to pay for. So the desire is there to really move forward with this.
Caitlin, thank you for joining us here on the Roundup. Caitlin McLeod covers education for the South Florida Sun Sentinel with us from our studios in Doral. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, talking about the potential of a significant lawsuit against the state of Florida by public school districts. And let's move to the reality of a lawsuit filed against the state of Florida this week. A man who many think wants to be the next governor of Florida is suing the state. John Morgan is a personal injury lawyer in Orlando, but he's also been the driving voice and pocketbook behind efforts to approve constitutional amendments allowing medical marijuana in the Sunshine State. His second effort succeeded, with 71% of voters approving the measure last November. But in a lawsuit filed this week on Thursday, Morgan claims the rules passed by lawmakers violate the intent of what voters okayed last fall. Now, legislators banned smoking marijuana, but allowed patients to vaporize or vape pot when they approved legislation during a special session just last month in Tallahassee. Governor Rick Scott signed the bill, and it went into effect last week, and that led to Morgan's lawsuit. Here's John Morgan.
The people of Florida knew exactly what they were voting on when they voted. And when they were voting on it, the vast majority, if not 100%, knew that smoke was included. So the fact that we're here today is really unnecessary, but here we go.
So if you voted for medical marijuana, did you assume patients could smoke it, or are eating and vaping marijuana enough? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or send us a note via Twitter at WLRN. Mary Ellen Klaus is still with us. She covers state government for a partner of the Miami Herald. Gary Fineout does it for the Associated Press, both of them with us from our sister station, WFSU. Mary Ellen, what are the rules currently for using prescribed marijuana?
In the implementing legislation that passed in the special session that was held in June, the legislature opened the door for, as you mentioned, edibles and vaping, and allowed for additional research at the Moffitt Center for potentially other avenues. But they specifically excluded as a medical use smoking. And that was something that was debated during the session. There was discussion that both sides had agreed to allow smoking, and then in the end, the final bill that came out excluded it. And here we go. We've got now the lawsuit. Now, what John Morgan wants to do is basically end the implementing bill invalidated, which would then trigger the Department of Health to set up the rules, and given the court's ruling on this, if the court agrees to invalidate it, the state would have no choice but to have to include smoking as an option.
Nick Evans is with us now, reporter for WFSU, who has followed the debate over medical marijuana over this past legislative session. Nick, if John Morgan is successful to throw out this legislatively approved law, would it essentially be an end around around the Florida legislature?
It certainly could be. The Department of Health hasn't really done a whole lot in going out on the limb. So I would tend to think that if he's successful in this lawsuit, I'm not 100% sure. I think that it would actually be – my guess is it would be severable. I think that he asks that the enforcement of the smoking or being able to provide marijuana in a form for smoking would be unenforceable. So that, generally speaking, the other elements of the law would remain in effect, but – the state of Florida wouldn't be able to enforce its ban on smokable marijuana.
So, Nick, what does the amendment say about smoking marijuana for medical reasons?
So this is really fun. I mean, you can really tell that a lawyer wrote this, right? Because it only refers to smoking negatively in saying that you can't smoke publicly. Now, when Mr. Morgan came up here to Tallahassee to talk to the press corps about this, he gave this example of like a kid at a hotel pool. It says you can't smoke at, or not you can't smoke, you can't swim,
you can't swim.
after right, 9 p.m. and you can't swim before 8 a.m. So of course that any first grader would know that you can swim between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m.
Yeah. He also said if something is not allowed in public, it is allowed in private. Now that seems
right,
to be
right.
a pretty slippery slope right there if we're to follow
exactly.
that
exactly. Exactly, but that is the that's the hill that he wants to die on. So we'll see. It's going to be a very interesting argument. I could see a lot of fireworks when this ends up in court, and I think that he's going to really push that idea. We'll see how it goes.
The previous effort for Mr. Morgan and medical marijuana failed to reach the 60% threshold an election cycle ago, and then he
barely.
Rewrote it. It was barely missed. That's true, but it did miss. It was rewritten, and it got approved by 71% of voters who voted in the November election. So under this amendment, Nick, what can marijuana be prescribed for?
Well, let's see here. There's a total of 10 conditions. I don't have them right in front of me, but they're the usual suspects: cancer, mm-hmm. epilepsy, AIDS, HIV, ALS, PTSD, and other conditions of a similar caliber, I guess. And it sort of leaves it up to the physician to decide
right.
if a condition meets that criteria.
Gary Feinert with the Associated Press, you're trying to get in there. Go ahead.
Well, no, all I was sort of going to say to you is that because I did not go to law school, I can't remember the exact Latin phraseology that is. But essentially the argument that Morgan is making is if it's not explicitly banned anywhere,
right,
if
right.
it's not explicitly, that you should assume that if something is absent, then it's allowed. And that is a longstanding legal theory that has been out there in many instances dealing with many laws and many things of that nature. So it's not surprising that he would say, look, we didn't put it in the amendment, which means it's allowed because we didn't explicitly ban it.
Right.
And of course, it is important to remember that these constitutional amendments, they have to be drawn fairly narrowly because you can't have multiple subjects covered in an amendment if it's done by the people, if it's a citizen initiative. And so this had to be – and that, you know, it was reviewed by the state Supreme Court and what have you. But I just wanted to say, I mean, the point is that looking at his I read his lawsuit. I read his initial filing. And I think it's going to be very interesting because I think I could see a scenario where a court would in fact go along with his theory. And I would just note that the judge that was assigned –
Yes.
to the lawsuit just yesterday is a judge who has in the recent past has ruled against the legislature, has ruled against the state, has ruled against the governor. Now, she's been overturned on occasion, but what I would say is in round one, I would say I think that there's a good chance that she will heed some of the things that are being argued.
One of the interesting things is, if they knew they intended to allow smoking, why didn't they include that specifically in the amendment? So we asked John Morgan that question, and he said, well, we didn't have to because everyone just assumed that it was going to be allowed and we're going to prove the negative, mm-hmm. right? I think there's another answer, and I don't know what it is, mm-hmm. but I'm going to guess it was that strategically – they didn't want to include the word smoking because they didn't want to give the ammunition that this is just going to be another avenue into recreational marijuana.
Yep.
To smoke or not to smoke medical marijuana in the state of Florida, that is the focus of a lawsuit filed against the state this week. Let's go to your phone calls here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We'll begin with the marijuana topic on line one in Davie. James is joining us. James, you are on the radio. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Good day. I voted for the constitutional amendment, and I agree with Morgan that it seemed that it was included, smoking would be included in the the proposition of it. And I'll take my discussion off the air. Thank you.
Great. James was a supporter and assumed that even though smoking wasn't specifically designated, that it would be included, which is exactly the argument that Mr. Morgan is making and likely will make in front of the bar. Melissa, on line two in Deerfield Beach. Melissa, you're on the radio. Go ahead. Your thoughts for the roundup.
Hi. I am an attorney and a promoter, was a promoter of the cannabis statute. I know it was kind of scoffed at, that language and that argument that Mr. Morgan is making, but I see the merit in the argument. And those words are chosen very carefully, and there's a reason why certain people write them. And so the comment also was made that, maybe it wasn't explicitly put in there because we didn't want to have the impression or the stigma that this would become recreational. And I agree with that. I could definitely see that that could be part of it. And why it wasn't explicitly stated, but it was intentionally partially stated, and that's extremely noteworthy and can't be ignored.
How was it partially stated? How was smoking marijuana, medicinal marijuana, partially stated?
So the fact that it's referenced at all, so if you dissect those words, that it's referenced that it can't be done publicly, just automatically gives a logical conclusion that in some capacity it can be done. So the converse of that is, however you want to argue about it or come to whatever that practicality is, those words being there in and of themselves intimate that there's something is okay. There's some way that it's okay to smoke the cannabis in the statute. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been mentioned. It would have either been, and of course, I understand the argument why wasn't it explicitly defined. And I agree that the kind of subtext is, well, we wanted people to vote for the bill. And we didn't want to have this. We didn't want to have this this negative stigma associated with the bill, which really is to promote that medical right. use and not that recreational use.
Yeah, in this case, the amendment, not the bill, but understood the point
I'm
there,
sorry,
Melissa,
yes,
from
yes,
Deerfield
amendment.
Beach. Yeah, got it. Thank you very much for your thoughts here on the roundup. Let's continue. Let's go up north to West Palm Beach in Palm Beach County on line three. David, you are on the radio. Thanks for joining the roundup. Your thoughts?
Hi. Yes, I also voted to approve it and have been in some other states. I have a little bit of knowledge on it. I'm not a physician, but I do know that there's over 400 chemicals in the plant itself, 200 of them being active. Now, here's the point of that is that when you make the actual flower into a oil, a lot of those chemicals are destroyed during the process. And some of those chemicals can help for different debilitating conditions when they are. So basically what I'm trying to say is when you take THC, that might help something, but THC mixed with another chemical may, really help.
A little bit of a biochemistry lesson there from West Palm Beach, David. We appreciate your thoughts. One final call I want to take on line one. John is joining us from Miami Beach. John, your perspective on this issue.
Yes, so cigarette smoking is banned and marijuana now is encouraged. How upside down is the whole country? Marijuana smoking is far more addictive and destabilizing. You're going to have airline pilots and people driving trucks who are stoned or semi-stoned. What's up? It just makes no sense.
John,
all of it is obviously a smokescreen to have recreational smoking of pot all over the place. They started with this so-called medicinal, and the oil should certainly suffice. If this guy is bringing a lawsuit, the lawyer, he's very savvy. He wanted to just turn a little ways to get the thing passed and then protest that it should be smoked for the purpose of legalizing pot to smoke all over at any time.
John, it's an important insight you have, and I want to put that to the panel, Gary, Mary Ellen, and Nick. That is giving voice to what those critics in the legislature have said who voted for this smoking ban of medical marijuana to contend that allowing it would be a step toward recreational marijuana use in Florida.
Well, I think that the first thing I would point out is there are, I think, many people that would push back on the idea that marijuana is highly addictive, that be that as it may. The question of whether or not smoking it is valid or not, I mean, that, I think that's sort of in the eye of the beholder. You know, one of the things that was pointed out is that, you know, the sort of the conditions that a person would have to be eligible to get medical marijuana under these provisions are conditions where you really are pretty darn close to death's door, or in a place that's so you know debilitating that really getting into the question of whether or not this may harm your lungs years, decades down the line is really just beside the point. So we'll see what the judge has to say, but I'm not sure that the allowing smoking is going to move directly, you know, from point A to point B to recreational marijuana.
And I'd like to add that we in Tallahassee have had a really interesting window into how this process has changed minds. So I can sympathize with the caller that he believes that this is really just a backdoor way into getting recreational marijuana all around the state. However, this is a conservative Republican legislature. Mm-hmm. And remember, they passed a medical marijuana law before this even was on the ballot. And they did it because they anticipated it was coming on the ballot. And they were persuaded by the sympathetic stories of people who felt that there was some medical remedy for their ailment that the medical delivery of cannabis would provide. And it was fascinating to watch these conservative naysayers turn around and become advocates of it. And it's because of the stories and the experience in other states. Florida is not the first one to go this direction. And so, you know, while I think public sentiment is very mixed, there is a lot of people who have had personal experience with watching this have some effect.
Jim, on line one, a positive effect of the ability to have access to medical marijuana. Jim, on line one in Coral Gables, tells us he is one of those. Jim, go ahead. Your story, sir.
Good afternoon. I'm stage four colon cancer patient. And, you know, marijuana has helped me so much in going through this. I've been going through it for about 3 years. I've had 10 surgeries, ridiculous amounts of chemo, which I'll never do again. But there's been times when I've been doubled over in pain or whatever and able to go outside and smoke a little and get instant relief. And, you know, I won't do drugs as far, you know, for pain medication. And just all
Jim,
around.
Jim, pardon the interruption. Is your marijuana prescribed to you currently?
No, it is not. No, it's all illegal, you know. I guess it would be. But it's kind of like, I don't care. What are you going to do, take me to jail? I've got a chemo port. And anyway, it just seems ludicrous to me that, first of all, this 90-day waiting period, my God, someone's in pain. Give them some help. And that last caller that said cigarettes are legal and marijuana's not, well, that's just stupid. So anyway.
Jim, we appreciate you sharing your story with us. And best of luck on your health. We hope
thank you very
pull
much.
Through there. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Nick Evans with WFSU watching the marijuana debate with our partner station in Tallahassee. Thank you for your thoughts. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press, Mary Ellen Kloss with our partner, the Miami Herald. Stick with us here. I want to talk quickly about a lawsuit or a series of lawsuits that the state no longer will face. And these are lawsuits over gambling, an apparent settlement in the 2+ year legal fight and tussle between the state and the Seminole tribe over blackjack. The tribe wants its casinos to be the only places where gamblers can play the card game. The state wants money to grant that exclusivity. A settlement was announced this week. $340 million will go to the state. Mary Ellen Kloss, how significant of a settlement is this?
Well, I think it is significant because it means they're going to stop fighting for a while. And what's even more interesting is that this could have a lasting implication on the ability of the legislature to negotiate an alternative direction, with the paramutuals. So the short answer is that we have $340 million the state now has access to, which is great news for legislators and the governor. It's not money that we didn't know was already there. Right. It's been sitting in reserve, but now they can use it.
Gary, does this end the conflict, or does it just delay the conflict between the Seminole tribe and the state over gambling and the potential expansion?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I know that I had a conversation with one state senator, Bill Galvano from Bradenton, who has been very much deeply involved in all the gambling legislation that has happened in the last decade. And I think he was still evaluating it. And I think in part of his mind it was, well, the settlement does kind of put the legislature in a box and kind of takes them out of play to some extent. Because if you recall on the original dispute, the idea was that the 2010 agreement between the tribe and the state allowed them to operate blackjack for 5 years. And then there was an option to extend it, and that there was a disagreement as to whether or not they had to pull out the tables and what was going to happen next. This essentially, by memorializing the initial court ruling in this case, allows the Seminoles to keep blackjack tables until 2030. And so you have a legislature that says, well, wait, we thought we were going to have the final say on whether or not that was going to happen. And then so they're a little bit troubled by, well, how do we deal with this? And, of course, there's also language in the settlement that says that the state will aggressively enforce going after a type of card game that the Seminoles have contended violates the compact, and that the state has allowed other dog and horse tracks to use. So, well, you might have the tracks say, well, no, we're going to fight you on that if you try to come after us. So I'm not sure everything's all wrapped up. And then there's a last thing. It's kind of a little bit arcane, but mm-hmm. there is the issue as the settlement agreement talks about taking money and moving it from – it had been sequestered sort of voluntarily. And then it says, well, it's going to go into the main budget account of the state, which is known as general revenue, and that the state is going to continue to receive money over the next year. There is a small argument that can be made that the governor cannot sign something that says where money is going to go, because that's the province of the legislature, the ability to appropriate money.
That's
so
right.
I'm not saying the legislature is going to try to fight it. I'm just saying I know there's a lot of grumbling, and a lot of grumbling could lead to somebody deciding to do something.
So the legislature is under a lot of pressure to expand gambling and get rid of greyhound racing and horse racing, and instead expand casinos in those paramutuals. And now they don't have the leverage they thought they have against the Seminole tribe to get the tribe to come on board, because mm-hmm. because the state's basically said, well, you get to keep the thing that's so lucrative for you, and that's your blackjack tables and card games. And so now that they feel like they've lost some leverage against in that negotiation as they're trying to figure out what to do for paramutuals.
Where it goes from here. Marilyn Kloss, watching Tallahassee for our partner, the Miami Herald. Gary Fineout doing the same for the Associated Press. Thanks to both of you for all of your insights and perspectives here on the Florida Roundup. We're going to take a quick break, and still to come, an extra night in jail leads to a lawsuit against Miami-Dade County and its cooperation with immigration authorities. That's next as the Roundup continues. We'll be right back.